back, season 5 of the Telly Award-winning podcast, coming at you like James Todd Smith, better known as Ladies Love Cool James, even better known as LL Cool J. Don't call it a comeback. We've been here for years, rocking our peers, putting suckers in fear, making the tears rain down like a monsoon. Listen to the bass go boom. I am Rylan Grant, screenwriter, Ringo Award-winning creator of fine comics like Aberrant, Banjax, and The Jump, the man in the box to the left. The other voice in the dark is...
David Avalone, writer, comic books, TV, movies, and going back to Cali.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, Mama said knock you out and all that. if you missed any of our previous conversations, episodes featuring comic luminaries like David F. Walker, Matt Fraction, Stan Sakai, Kevin Eastman, Rodney Barnes, and many, many more. Did Patton Oswalt recently? Mm-hmm. Did Chris Ryall recently? Those were a couple of our best shows. So double on back and check all that out. You find those on YouTube. You find them on Apple Pods. You find them wherever you get your ear cracks. So do that. LL Cool J, great guy. You know, I spent the better part of a day with him. My first job in Hollywood was shadowing Oliver Stone when he was prepping Any Given Sunday. And he did all of his, I've talked about this a little bit on the show before, but he did all of his, you know, principal casting. And he was running behind often, like, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 hours behind. And so a lot of my job was, hey, LL Cool J is in the conference room. He is getting impatient. Why don't you go in and entertain him for an hour and a half? And so I went in there. I got him a Snapple. I turned on SportsCenter and we shot baskets for about an hour and a half. Great guy.
Nice.
Yeah, big fan of his. But we have a great guest today. But let's see some house cleaning. What do you got to sell today, Avalone?
Well, coming out today, because today is Wednesday, is Drawing Blood, Part the Third.
Oh, nice.
Which is the comic that I co-created with Kevin Eastman, which is coming from Image. Which the whole how did it work when we self-published versus how is it going from Image will be relevant to our later conversation, I think.
There you go.
And last week, the Elvira meets Vincent, I keep doing that. Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft miniseries wrapped up with issue 5. And that should still be in your store, unless it's sold out, which is always nice. Rylan, what do you got going on?
A couple of movies out. State of Consciousness is streaming right now. Haunted Heart. Just did a big festival thing. I mean, it was at Cannes there, sold in the Cannes market. But this weekend was the Mallorca Film Festival. The director, Fernando Trueba, owns a home in Mallorca and is a big fan there. And so Matt Dillon was out there. Who else was out there? Michael Douglas was out there. It was cool. So standing ovation there. So it's a good one. We should see it later in the summer, early fall. So nice. Stay tuned for that. Look, check me out on the social meds and I'll tell you where you can find that one. Peacekeeper is coming to you very soon, and new book announcement coming up. So nothing too concrete right now, but it's coming. But let's stop yapping and let's get Dave on. He's more interesting
than we
are.
Dave Blanch.
Yo, yo, yo.
Hey guys.
Yo, yo, yo.
By the way, I don't know if I can follow up stories of Lickin' Lips Cool J and Patton Oswalt. I think I've got giant shoes to fill, but
ooh, wow.
I will be licking my lips. So here we go.
Lickin' Lips Cool J. I love it. Wow.
I mean, yeah, you see any of those videos and you're like, man.
Yeah,
he's got a problem.
Yeah.
He needs some chapstick. He needs some moisturizer.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Seriously,
he's a problem. Would have gone a long way.
In the '90s.
And speaking of going back to Cali, you're in Colorado, right?
I am coming back to Cali for San Diego Comic Con. I'll see you guys there, right?
I'm sure. Yeah. Getting it done. Yeah, we'll be doing it and doing it and doing it. Will.
There it is. Yeah, I'm just going to be walking around with a handheld the whole time. I stopped having a table. I missed Comic-Con. I got stuck in Portugal. I know, like, wow, I got stuck in Portugal. But they kept pushing my flight back, and it would have had to have been literally, like, fly back to Colorado, grab my crap, and then have already missed 2 days. Yeah, so yeah. I skipped out like 2 years ago, and I haven't really looked back. I don't have that FOMO that I used to have.
Yeah.
So I just kind of pop in and hang out with, you know, people like you guys. And
a San Diego table is a lot like a New York City apartment. Like, if you've got it, you've had it for 40 years and you inherited it from your grandfather. Like, it's not a reasonable thing for a reasonable person that a reasonable person can just go and like, I believe I would like one of those. Let me spend an inordinate amount of money on it.
It's like, I mean, you know, when you're starting out and you're like, man, you know, those conventions where you're like, I did so well. I made back my table. Well, good luck. Good luck at San Diego. I mean, you'll make money, but you're also paying for, you know, expensive hotels. And
Will never not be, you know, again, not to sound all highfalutin in Portugal, but, you know, I've traveled in Europe and I have never paid in any of the great capitals of Europe what I pay for a hotel room in Sandy fucking Ago in late July, like the worst possible time to be in San Diego, California. It's like I've had beautiful hotel rooms in Rome that were half the price that I pay to stay in a dump in San Diego.
Yeah, things are just
never not
just wired differently in Europe. Like, you call an Uber and like a guy in a suit driving a limo rolls up, and you're like, wait, where am I? Who am I? You know, it's a completely different thing. Now, that's the other thing, though. What we need to do is figure out how to do this so that we can travel. Now, you didn't get to go to Mallorca, did you?
So we originally wrote this, the movie takes place on a Greek island. So we were trying to get a sense of island life, and we did they eventually flew me to Greece to prep the movie. But the first thing they did was when we were writing the final draft, the final first draft of the script. That's a weird sentence, but I think you get what I'm saying. We did it in Mallorca. So I did. Okay. That was a hell of a time. It was gorgeous.
I love working vacations. That's the best.
I do. It's a funny thing. Like, some people are like, no, man, I just want to lie on a beach for 3 days. And I love those vacations too. But I've done a lot of production travel. And there's something about the way in which you interact with your environment and the locals if you're there to do something.
Yeah.
Rather than if you're there. I was in France for 10 days in 2016 making a World War I documentary. And it was a superior experience to the time I went to Paris and just saw the things, you know, and just, oh, I guess I'll go up in the Eiffel Tower and do whatever. I guess I'll go into the Louvre and look at the idiots looking at the Mona Lisa.
At the back
of the heads of the people looking at the Mona Lisa.
You're there figuring out how stuff works, and because you have to actually portray it in a meaningful way. And that was the, you know, this film took place on a Greek island. So when we were in Greece, I mean, we're there like the film's going to shoot in a couple of weeks. And so we are trying to figure out, I'm there with the director. We're changing the script. We're trying to get the film on its feet. Where are we going to shoot this? Where are we going to shoot that? And you just see all these things. I mean, the film, I don't know if I'm blanking out there. Sorry about that. But the film takes place at a restaurant. And so a restaurant on a Greek island is run a lot differently than a restaurant here in the States. And we wrote the first draft of the script about 16 years ago. And so, like, you know, we are in LA at first imagining this restaurant on a Greek island. And so there are things you don't get right. And I remember, so we would wait, we're on this Greek island. We would wake up, we'd, you know, sort of, I don't know, we'd fart around for a little bit. We'd walk down to a restaurant and get some food. And we walked there, and the proprietor of this restaurant was this really, really colorful guy, you know, just big and gregarious and awesome and hugging you. And he loved us. And he's so great. He's so glad that there's like a movie there. And so we're walking down for an early lunch, and he's standing in front of this fucking cement mixer, right? And we're like, what the hell is he doing? Like, is he pouring a foundation or what? And he does one of these, reaches up to us, and then he digs into the cement mixer, and he pulls a fucking octopus out of the cement mixer. And he's like,
what?
And he drops it in, and it turns, so octopus is, it can be tough. You have to tenderize it, and there are any number of ways to tenderize it. This guy got like a low key cement mixer. It's out in the back of this restaurant. And so in the morning, you know, I mean, they're plucking these octopi right out of the Mediterranean. And then he drops them in these, in the cement mixer. And so again, like, if you want these amazing little like real touches that you can't write this shit touches in your script about a restaurant on a Greek island, that went into the movie right off the bat. And there's just no other way to get that, you know? and it's brilliant. It's like the, you know, it's details like that that make something good great, or hey, you know, make something terrible like passable or whatever. But yeah,
I always say if you do your research, it's just like it's so much shit being handed to you on a silver platter.
Yeah.
Like, here's some great story ideas that are just lying around waiting for you to look in their direction, honestly. And yeah, the bad filmmakers are the ones who show up to Grease and do not alter their screenplay based on their knowledge of restaurants in Los Angeles at all. And just go like, no, do it my way. This is the way I, the genius artist, envisioned it. It's like, no, man, that's not the real world. That's the... You know, I think Fellini said something about like a script is a map and the movie is the journey you took using the map. And the map's going to be wrong. The map's not going to know there was construction on that street when you get there. And you're going to have to go off in a whole other direction you didn't know that you had to go in. And that's, you know, that's.
So, yeah. That's so what you're saying is do your own research, bro.
Yeah. Your own research, bro. Exactly. And your research is not doing listening to some YouTube video of a guy who tells you he did the research. That's actually not research. Yeah.
Have we actually introduced Dave? I don't know that we have. We got right into it as we tend to do. But
at home about yourself and LL Cool J.
Yeah. So Dave DeLaunch, creator of Indie Comics, had a little brush with fame with Jenny Zura over at Dark Horse. Still making comics, man. That's me.
Yeah, and we should disclose right off the bat, I owe a lot to Dave, because in a way, Dave gave me my first shot in comics. So
I also probably gave you your first experience of comic failure. So that's, you know, you can punch me later.
You know what? I got a Ringo Award sitting on the on the mantle, and it's partially because of you giving me a shot. So so I will take that as a win, even though.
Well, let's dig into that origin story. What was the shot?
I decided to, I mean, we've covered this a little bit, but you know, I decided to swerve into the comic book lane. It was something I wanted to do for a very long time. I tried to do it in college, but it was a different time back then. You know, there wasn't digital workflow. You know, we're dealing with physical drawings. It wasn't this international marketplace like it is now. You had to know an artist in your town. You're dealing with physical drawings. Where do you take it to get published after that? All of that stuff. And so tried, failed in college, but you know, it was, you know, the world changed very radically. And this was, you know, what is this? Is it 6-7 years ago now? You know, and I took another look, I you know, some people were encouraging me again. I took a look at the marketplace and it was just different. You did have a digital workflow. You know, you had these huge online communities of international artists who were just, you know, just happy for the work, right? And and so very quickly was able to kind of put something together, and had an artist in Hungary and a colorist in Indonesia and a letterer in the UK, like overnight. And I was, you know, communicating with them via email and, you know, paying them via PayPal. And it just came together very quickly in a way that it couldn't have even just a few years ago. And I think that, you know, things have improved vastly even since then. It's just it's a different game. So making comics has never been more possible. So if you're listening to this, a lot of our people are creators, but a lot of our listeners are would-be creators. Go out and make a goddamn comic. It's doable now. But there was always this question. And it's a question we'll wrestle with over the course of the show is, well, you have a comic done, then what the hell do you do with it? And I started looking at publishers, and at that point, Dave was the, were you the president? Were you the,
you know, I started out as a creative director, there, and then, they moved me into presidency for like a year. And, you know, I think what happens and, you know, so like what we're talking about, it was Abbott was the first one. Is that right?
Yeah.
So. You know, I had the greatest job on the planet at first, which was just finding cool shit to make, you know, and like plucking things out of the ether and making it real for people. There you go. And that was the most fun we had, you know, the company, I don't know if we're going to mention names, but I've been calling it Voldemort Press.
There you go.
We don't talk about the name, but.
It was at the time a very solid middle tier publisher, and things have changed a little bit since then, but yeah, go ahead.
A lot of bit. Yeah, sure. It was, you know, it was one of those things where or five fairly like-minded people sitting around a really unsuccessful comic convention, you know, as we do, you commiserate over beer at the con bar. And we were just kind of looking around this round table and thinking, you know, I have impeccable taste. I could be a creative director. I've got a face guy in Sean Pryor. I've got the most solid editor on the planet in Sean Gabarin. And there were a couple other people involved that brought in like a business person, because, you know, obviously none of us were business people. And the way we backdoored our way into comics was so very strange. Like the first group of books that we did, rather than pay for printing, we bought a frigging printer and printed the books ourselves. So they were garbage, but they were also books that were like getting Eisner and award nominations all over the place. So, you know, from there it built up fairly organically. But there was always just one thing about that company that I hated, and it was the contract, the nebulous nature of the contract, which, you know, I think a lot of companies are better about. And then there are a lot of companies that have the same exact contract. It's just stated in the contract. It's not nebulous, but it's there. Right. So, so, you know, like Bryce said, everyone can make a comic and everyone should, if that's the passion. Right. But like, just make sure that you're signing the right contract. Because I take it like a marriage, right? Like if I'm not in it and I'm not going to look back 10 years later and be happy with what I did 10 years ago and where I'm at today, I'm going to want a divorce. And now you're telling me legally I can't get a divorce. Right. It's an insane prospect to have in your life, to be like, oh, fortune and glory are just like one step away. But this person's going to hold me on a leash for the rest of my life. Right. Yeah. So,
I always say, let's talk about all this stuff while we're still friends.
Oh, right. Well, and you know, it's crazy.
Let's make the what if we hate each other in 5 years conversation happen. And what are we going to do about that? Because so many people don't think about that. And, you know, I have had some of the most, what I would have called the two most solid friendships in my life fell apart. So, if those fell apart, why should I believe a publisher I talked to for 20 minutes at a bar at a convention is going to be my bestest friend forever, who's always going to have my back and yada, yada, yada. So it's always good to have those. And, you know, we've talked about this before, obviously, but in every industry that involves creative folk, there's this, oh, you're not going to read the contract. You're just going to sign it because you want this too badly to read it. And I have honestly had situations where companies with shitty contracts have thanked me for bringing in a lawyer and pointing out all of the crazy Swiss cheese holes in their contract and saying, do you guys know you've got this thing that you clearly downloaded off the internet, this contract, and tried to alter it and it doesn't make any sense? Like, are you guys aware of what that clause you have in there actually means and how it screws everybody? Like, so it's... I will say I'm on a message board for a writer's group that I'm in, and we were talking about contracts, and some editor said, well, if a writer tells me he's hiring a lawyer to look at my contract, I know I'll never work with that guy again. And I'm like, there is not a bigger, like, there are parades in Beijing with fewer red flags.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Like, holy shit. Like, you should be thrilled that I'm going to enter into a business or a business contract with you and know what I'm doing and feel good about it. You should think that's a positive thing. Yeah. Not a, oh, I can't have lawyers looking at this thing.
And if you feel like you can't ask questions or make suggestions in any relationship, what kind of relationship is that?
Yeah.
Right? So, an abusive one. Well, and then, you know, like you kind of said it, like creators that are hungry. Like I always said at Voldemort Press that if, like, I am perfectly comfortable with this being your first book and us boosting your signal and you graduating and moving on to larger publishers or better contracts. Cause I was like, this contract is garbage and I'm just going to let you know right now. Yeah. But when they made me president, I was like, fuck yeah, I get to change all this shit. Now I'm the president. Right. And then like Voldemort himself was like, no, you're not allowed to do any of that. We're never doing that ever. So at that point, the clock was ticking. Like, how long am I going to be here? And, you know, I have a really good corporate gig and it allows me to pay for my own production on books, and allows me, you know, the luxury of being able to shop my books around it. And, you know, sometimes you look at it and you're like, Jenny Zero is a dark horse book. I would not want it anywhere else. But if that contract was not to my liking, I would have walked away from that contract. Yeah, bar none. Like, I'm not that hungry because, you know, to paraphrase Jurassic Park, you know, like, comics will find a way, you know? So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm very interested in what we as a group think that, you know, some of these publishers have to offer us. I think that when we look at Dark Horse, it is very obvious what Dark Horse has to offer us, right? I mean, it is instant legitimacy. It is a big league situation. There are very few of those left anymore. Image is certainly one. Image is its own thing. And the weird twist is that the Image contract is better than any contract you're going to get in terms of rights and in terms of respect for the creator and all that stuff. Probably because it was a company started by creators that was trying to honor creators and do right by creators.
Well, also because they're not paying you anything though.
Very generous
with your rights because they don't pay.
They don't pay a page rate, but also they're not, you know, also they're not taking a percentage. They take a fair and reasonable distribution fee, and the rest is yours. And so it's either your book does well or it doesn't. And you're never going to get rich making comic books. Obviously, we all know that. Thank God Dave has his corporate gig. Thank God, we do other things, but for me, the Dark Horse thing is very easy. And I feel like, well, maybe even like 3 years ago, there were maybe like four or five Dark Horses, and now maybe there's only Dark Horse. Yeah. A lot of these other publishers, I wonder what they offer anymore, you know? Mm-hmm. And here's the thing is, like, I think they offered more like 2 years ago than they do now. Mm-hmm. And what we have seen and the pandemic and all of this stuff has kind of thrown gasoline on this fire is that, well, I don't know. There used to be self-publishing used to be a failure, right? It used to be looked down upon. That is no longer the case. It is, in a lot of ways to me, it is the preferred option because I am a guy who, I mean, I've covered it, just ad nauseum on this show, but it's like my business for the last 10 years has been creating IP, setting up IP in Hollywood, getting paid to write the IP in Hollywood. And so for me to control the IP is this very important thing, but it's important for all of us, right? But I had this IP knowledge going in, and so I was able to kind of navigate the contractual situation a little bit better than maybe some were who were kind of fighting off their back initially. That said, that first contract was pretty shitty. My second contract with the same company, with Voldemort Press, was better. And my third contract with another company was air fucking tight. And only because I had the experience of the other two contracts, probably. But I do wonder, like, what do we think? Again, it's very clear what a Dark Horse offers. Like, what does, if Voldemort Press, and there are other Voldemort Presses right now, what does a company like that offer a creator right now?
One of the things that the contracts are so strange. It feels like a lot of publishers want to be movie people, or they were movie people that are now comic book people, and they want to attach themselves as executive producer of your whatever your 4-issue miniseries is.
Yeah.
But, you know, I find, and you would know better than I, but like my experience in Hollywood is that why the fuck would I want that person as an executive producer on my project? You're basically killing the project by inserting yourself into a process that you have no business being in.
And I've seen it happen with Voldemort, where it didn't happen with me, but it happened with friends, where it's like, well, Voldemort wants his six-figure fee, and it's like, well, why? What is he doing? What is he bringing to the table exactly? And so I'm gonna hold this thing hostage, and people don't want your IP after that because Voldemort is going to hold it hostage. And you're hitting on a great point here, and let me just say it explicitly, is that Voldemort Press was one of these, but there are others where a lot of these smaller companies, they are IP farms, and that's all they are. Voldemort was coming in. He was doing very little, and he's putting these out in the marketplace. And the annoying part is that everyone else at that company was so great. I mean, I don't have a bad thing to say about anyone else who worked at the company. Like, and in fact, you know, I mean, you and I get along like fucking gangbusters, you know, and you know, and I can just go down Sean, Jason, you know, just everybody was so amazing. And when he is surrounded by really soulful, great people who are trying to do something incredible. And the reason that there were Eisner nominations and Ringo Awards and all of these things was because of the work that you guys were doing. Like, that was very clear. So he has this cover, right? Like, oh, look, this is a legitimate thing. Like they're doing something great and interesting. Really, but he is not interested in any of that stuff. Everyone else is.
Right.
Everyone else is having a very hard time doing something great because he is sabotaging things behind the scenes because all he is interested in, it is an IP farm for him. He is he is collecting and hoarding lottery tickets. Go ahead.
He wants to be a executive producer on everything that gets made. He's not hitting the bricks and hitting the pavement and shopping those things around. Yeah. Nor does he have any real representation. So he's just literally waiting for someone to give him a handout and then choking the life literally out of every project that he's holding on to because they're dead now, right?
Yeah, I mean,
Five years of the company, I was stacking the deck like crazy. And then, you know, like every company at that level, the minute that you get like any modicum of success, you're like, fucking let's go 10 times the amount of books. And you're like, man, no, I would rather have 3 good books a year than 25 meh, okay books that you're going to hold hostage. Right. I mean, like how many creators stopped creating comics because they had the one idea that then got choked out of their lives.
Yeah. Right?
It's like,
it's terrible,
I mean, luckily, you know, Rylan, super creative, always working, right?
Yeah.
Like, I would say the same about me. Like,
100%.
I intentionally, and this is crazy, no one really asked me to do it, but I never signed a contract. And then on my way out, I said, fuck you, I stand with the creators. I signed all my shit away. And my wife was so pissed at me. And I'm like, but it's the right thing to do. Like, no one asked me to do it. So when people come up to me and, you know, I do get shit on it, like conventions sometimes. People come up and be like, oh, I know you. You're from Voldemort. Yeah. And I'm like, cool, whatever. Or, hey, you ghosted me. No, I just ran for the hills and told everyone else to do the same thing.
Right? Yeah, you didn't even run for the hills because I watched you. It's when the building was on fire, you stayed in the building and you said, hey, guys, here's the door. And I don't know how many times you called me while the building was burning. I mean, it was in the dozens and talked me through things and pointed me at this. I saw firsthand, you felt a real responsibility to the people that you had brought in and, you know, and I was never mad at you. I didn't feel like you know what I'm saying? It was a him thing. It was a Voldemort thing. And like I said, with everybody, down to the person, everyone else who worked there, helped me put out a really great book that won awards. And it was a good enough experience with you guys. And I was able to change the contract enough the second time that I did a second book that was nominated for more awards and stuff like that. And so you guys made it a good experience. And I have to say is that I don't like to be in burning buildings, but we are all in our lives going to be in some burning buildings. And the next time I am in a burning building, then it'll happen. I hope there is someone there like Dave DeWanch to help me find the way out of it. So thank you for that.
Well, hopefully I was thinking this episode would be called Dave DeWanch, A Cautionary Tale, because it's like, you know, I've been sort of around the block on this a bunch and it's led me to, you know, a couple of really great interactions and business deals with certain publishers. I mean, people I would recommend, obviously Dark Horse and Image, Titan, like we have a really good working relationship. And, you know, the idea for me, the romanticism of being like, oh, it's a European publisher. Hell yeah. Like I've always been a Humanoids fan and Titan feels like, you know, a really good fit for me. They do a lot of crime books and my next book's a crime book and it just felt right. I'd had a really good experience working on a video game tie-in comic with them. And I just thought, hey, you know, let's just keep this rolling, keep the good vibes going, you know? I honestly think that once you find a home or a place that you're comfortable with, stick it out. You know, there's always give and take, but if you can get the foundations built, it's like every relationship, you know, I mean,
Yeah.
Well, no, I've been with Dynamite for a decade.
Yeah.
Pretty much my entire comic book career. And they have never let a year go by without printing something that I wrote, without asking me to do some book for them. And some years are, but like, particularly the last 5 years, it's been pretty much I always owe Joe Riband pages at Dynamite. There's always something that we're working on together. And there is, we're working on a creator-owned deal over there, which is not what they are known for. And I will say, honestly, like 5 years ago, I asked Riband about doing a creator-owned deal there. And he's like, not right now. I don't think he is. Like, he said something like, as the editor-in-chief of Dynamite, we're very excited for whatever you could bring us. As your friend Joe, I'm saying, maybe not right now. maybe you don't want to do that right now. But part of it, a lawyer that I was talking to about that contract said something very interesting to me, which is, why do you want to do this with these people? Why are you willing to do this? Why is this a better deal for you than just walking it, you know, trying to get it read at Dark Horse or Image? And I said, I have the cell number of the publisher of Dynamite.
Yeah.
I don't have Stevenson still. I mean, I think I do now, but I didn't, you know, now that I've got a book with him. But prior to that, I was like, I've known these guys a very long time, and, you know, and not to make it all about power relationships, but I've been writing the Elvira license for 5 years, and the licensor, Cassandra Peterson, loves me. And that is a golden goose that they are probably in no rush to kill. So they don't particularly want to screw me over, because I can destroy that license with a phone call. I mean, obviously it's not in my interest to do it.
Well, and you know, it's the comfortability. And then Rylan, you know, you were talking about your second contract, and, you know, I don't think you would have necessarily gotten that contract edited or, you know, the red line stuff changed, hadn't you been a screenwriter and there wasn't a potential for them to go other media with it. Right. Like you were like a fresh faced kid, you know, they would have just been like, no changes at all. And honestly, I appreciate that too. If you're not going to work with me, then cool. I can go somewhere else. Right. Like, I don't need them. And, you know, I have a Kickstarter running right now. It's one of those things where that book I feel is universal. I feel I could have gone to any publisher with it, but there are very few publishers that are not going to take my rights. Film rights. Well, and when I see that potential, I'm like, why would I give that up? That's my livelihood.
Well, exactly. And the thing where, and we should promo the Kickstarter right now, and we'll do it again at the end. We've been bad. We just jumped right into it. This is what we do. We just start talking. But you know, again, and publishing has changed so much that it used to be, well, you either go to Kickstarter or you go the traditional publishing route. That's not the way anymore. You do well on Kickstarter now. These publishers are like vultures. Like, they're circling. It's like, oh, it did well over here, it's going to do well over here. It's two different audiences, right? And so you know, you're not going to make money in comic shops generally. So make some money on Kickstarter and then go to the publisher, but be careful about it. And this you know, this rights issue is so important. And if you go to one of the good publishers, quote unquote, Image doesn't take any rights. Dark Horse has options. You can give them no rights, and that's totally fine. You can sign a deal with them that has limitation. You're signing a deal with them for a year, for 2 years, or whatever. And Dark Horse has a Hollywood arm, and they are a legitimate production company with legitimate producers, legitimate executives. They have offices in Los Angeles. And they have relationships at studios and relationships at agencies. And so you can sign a shopping agreement for your book with Dark Horse Films or whatever it's called. And they will actually do something with it. And the idea is that, well, we are going to spend a year pounding the pavement trying to get your book set up. And that is worth something. That is worth doing. It's a deal that I may even consider signing, right? But you have the option. It's not you have to do this, and it's not we're going to keep it forever. We're going to keep it forever, and you have no say in this, is walk away territory for me. And there are certain things, like you said, if you're a fresh-faced kid, you may have to take a bad deal, but you learn from it. And hopefully you make a name. It was the one thing I did where it was like my first deal was kind of rough, but it gave me enough juice later to demand better for the second deal, to demand exactly what I want for the third deal. And then what you're talking about is with those first couple of books, what it did is it legitimized me in the comic community. And so when I did go to Kickstarter, when I did get into the self-publishing game, I was not rando putting a book up, making $3,000 on my Kickstarter campaign. It was Ringo Award winner, Ryland Grant, creator of these books, coming to Kickstarter, and it was a $15,000 book instead of a $3,000 book. You know what I'm saying? And so again, we asked the question right off the bat, like, what is the value? A lot of times you can't measure the value right off the bat, right? If I don't do those books, if I don't take a shitty contract right off the bat, then I don't get to where I got.
Yeah.
But man, that math is hard to do. And it's particularly hard to do early on. It's particularly hard to see that far down the road, all of these things. But
and the thing about publishers, you know, sometimes people will tell me they're very excited about a deal they just made. And I have to bite my tongue instead of saying, I've never seen a book with that corner box ever in a comic book store. Right. So good. You know, like, and some, there are publishers I've heard of where it's like, I can't remember the last time a blank book, like I was looking down the road. I was like, oh, there's a book from, I'm not going to insult a bunch of publishers, but there's a handful of publishers that I know are out there making comic books. I haven't read anything of theirs in the last decade. I don't know anyone who's, and it's the same thing with, if someone wants to grab all the IP rights, you have the absolute right to say to them, great, what movies and television shows have you produced? What's your very successful background in moving comic book IP to the screen? And if you have no background, what have you got to offer me that I can't do myself?
It is crazy. Like for the Jenny Zero book, you know, we knew it was a Dark Horse book right when we sent it in. In fact, like they found us at a convention. It was really weird. I was like, this doesn't happen. But you know, they gave me the standard print contract. And I was like, well, what about other media? Because I'm inherently lazy. And I don't want to have to deal with that. Right. Mm-hmm. And I talked to the execs over on that branch of, in that branch of Dark Horse. And they were like, we love your book, but it is too big for it to be made into a movie, given the budgets that the budgetary constraints we know we have. Right. And I was like, wait, so you're going to publish my book and not take my rights? And I was like, yes, please. And I would have been perfectly fine with them taking them because that's just one less thing I've got to do. Right.
But well, and there's a cautionary tale I have told before, but it's an interesting, in the long run, it worked out. But at the very, very beginning of my career, before I had anything in print, a colleague liked an idea of mine, came on board because he was a very established comics writer. Came on board to co-write it with me, made cosmetic changes to my premise, and we brought it into Legendary, and Legendary offered us a really great comic book contract and a pretty shitty media deal. But I was brand new, and this comic creator actually had a TV show on the air at the time. So he advised not to do it, which where he was at in his career, maybe that was a smart thing to do. But all I could, you know, a few years later, I thought, you know what? If I had not gotten a dime on the movie deal, Legendary makes $200 million box office bonanzas. And this was a large, sprawling period action movie idea. And I was like, the trade-off for where I was in my career at that exact moment of getting screwed on a movie deal, but there being bus ads with, you know, George Clooney on them saying from the comic book by David Avalone and player to be named later. That would have been an incalculable leg up on things. And, you know, again, I have no regrets because I'm glad I'm not still doing business with that person who, you know, is no longer a part of my life for all sorts of good reasons, but not just the bad advice I got on that. But so it's a bullet dodged either way. But it's something that I say to beginners is like, you know, the first deal, it's okay to take a shitty deal. And the other thing I will say is if you're going to have a career at this, you can't be someone who just had one cool idea.
Yeah.
You got to have 1,000 cool ideas. You got to have enough stories to fill a monthly comic every month in and out in you know, year in, year out. You gotta be you can't make a living as a writer. There are notable exceptions, of course. You want to write To Kill a Mockingbird and then write nothing else for the rest of your life, that might work out for you. But if you're not writing To Kill a Mockingbird or Catcher in the Rye, you're going to need a second idea, possibly a 150th idea.
Yeah, I like to say,
if you're a real writer, you should enjoy coming up with those 150 ideas, by the way.
I always say, like, if you want to get struck by lightning, you better carry a lot of fucking weather vanes. It's not something that happens all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then yeah. Everyone is like, "Wow, instant success!" And you're like, "Fuckers, I've been here for like 25 years doing this, and you know, nothing has shaken me from it. It's dogged persistence and passion that gets you there. It's not the one idea, you know. Yeah. It's crazy. I like Titan has been my favorite experience so far, guys. I would recommend, you know, going and talking to Duncan over there. Good people. It's going to justify a working vacation in Europe. Mm-hmm. And right. I asked them about, you know, film and TV rights. And they're like, that's just not what we do currently. Yeah. They're like, we understand that if it does get made, that we are going to benefit from it. And we, you know, right. we're going to keep it in print as long as possible. Right. And then even more so if that happens. Right.
Yeah. That's the first conversation I had with Stevenson at Image. He's, you know, we were talking about the no, not taking any rights thing. And he says, every cocktail party I've ever been to, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said something like, you know, I tell people I run Image and, you know, we do The Walking Dead and they're like, oh, you must have made so much money off the TV deal. And he's like, not a dime.
Yeah.
And I said, but you're pretty happy the way those trade paperbacks sell when AMC drops a new season, right? And he's oh, yeah. Like, that's, you know, we're very happy to dominate the trade paperback bestseller list every single time there's a new season of Walking Dead. Like, that's the big bonus. That's where the money is.
But it's such rare air. And, you know, like the people behind that book were seasoned vets. Yeah. And to put out that book monthly already was a chore, right? I mean, I met Charlie a while back, and he and my wife just got up to no good. They were just crazy drunks. I'm not saying he's a drunk, but that night he definitely was. And we were just talking about the residuals of that. And he's like, yeah, I will keep working on this as long as humanly possible, because when that trade comes out, he's like, it basically takes care of the year. And then the page rate's fine, but everything else about it's just amazing, right?
Yeah, so, the mailbox money syndrome. I was friends with a music producer back in Jersey. I'm trying to remember which band it was, but there was some incredibly popular band that he produced two indie albums for them before they took off. And those two indie albums never sold well, but the band convinced their label to buy them from him. And he's like, it lasted about 3 years that I went to the mailbox once every 6 months, opened an envelope, and that I lived on that for a year.
Yeah.
You know? Oh, man. Could you imagine? I would love that. Let's go. Let's figure out how to crack that code, man. Jesus.
Yeah, no, royalties are, I learned that when I was 6 or 7 years old, I must have been 6 years old. My dad wrote the tie-in novels for the Partridge Family. And he had gotten screwed over on, and again, take the shitty deal the first time. He had gotten screwed over on The Man from U.N.C.L.E. They had paid him $1,000 flat to write one Man from U.N.C.L.E. novel. And they said, oh, no royalty. The show may not be a big hit or anything, but we'll hire you to write a dozen of these if the show's a big hit. Of course, the show was a big hit. And then they went to Harry Whittington and said, will you write the second one in the series? We're only giving you $1,000. But if the show continues to be a big hit, and there is a different writer on every Man from U.N.C.L.E. novel for that reason. So when the same publisher comes to him with Partridge Family, he says, you know, you're right. This might not be a big hit. It's no big deal. I'll write three novels for $1,500, but I want a crazy motherfucking royalty on every copy. And they were so short-term greedy. They went three novels for $1,500. That is nuts. And that's why I saw Europe three times as a child. like literally over and back on the Queen Elizabeth II, like, you know,
still spending that Partridge Family money.
We had crazy money for 3 years because guess what? Owning a big royalty on anything with a picture of David Cassidy or Susan Day on it in 1971 was the best possible business model. And again, he took care of he took advantage of their short-term greed.
Yeah.
And we're going, three novels we can publish right away for $1,500. Yeah, sure. Give them a nickel per every 35-cent copy. It's like, then it sells 3 million copies, and that's a lot of goddamn nickels.
Well, and you know, that probably also speaks to where your dad was at the time too, right? Like some people don't have the luxury of making that commitment, you know, and so they always want the immediate money. Like my first book at Titan, like I got paid just a shit ton of money for it. And it was because I was working with a video game developer themselves and not, they didn't have a publisher. So they were just paying me. And it was, you know, it was really good rates. And then the book came out through Titan, and it was like the number one YA book on Amazon for like 5 weeks in a row. And I was like, shit, I got no points on that. I got nothing on that. And I don't know. I don't even know what the numbers would have been or what that equates to being like the number one book on Amazon or whatever. But I'm banking it was a lot. And while I didn't get that money, which I was kind of like, oh, damn it, I made the connection. Right. And then because that book sold so well, it made it easier for Titan to say, let's take a chance on Dave now because of the project he's already been attached to. Right. So it all does work out. You just can't give up on that first one, because if you do, all you have are misgivings about the industry, really. You know, like there's never. I mean, honestly, I've been published by a bunch of different companies. And yeah, you're never 110% happy with everything that they did. There's always going to be like, God, I wish they had tweeted about that more, right? Well, fuck it, man. Just why don't you up your game then? You know, like Image is the same way. Best deal in town. But they have a set way of doing things, and they're not necessarily going to go and put all of their apples in your basket. They have 20 other books to promote that month, right? So there's a standard that they always adhere to, and they're great at what they do. Mm-hmm. But some people will be like, they didn't do enough. Well, that, you know, be aware that that's, you know, I always take a meeting with the marketing teams well before the books come out. What are you doing? What can I do? How can I help? You know, can I create unique experiences in advertising for you and for me? Because at the end of the day, I'm ultimately being selfish, actually. So what the fuck, you know what I mean? Like, all I'm going to do is blame myself if this fails.
But it also, I think it's a feedback loop. I think one of the reasons that Dynamite has been good and generous with me is, you know, and this is no disrespect to any of my fellow Dynamite stable workers, but I promote the shit out of my books. I push as hard as I can on every single Dynamite book, and I don't, you know, and I'm not getting a royalty on those. They're just everything that ups the public perception of those books is helpful to me, and there's no downside of that. I am an absolute podcast whore. I will go on any podcast that I'm asked on. I will do any interview. Like, I will go on the podcast that has 3 subscribers. I don't care, because there's a potential for 1 new reader there. And, you know, I will say, I have the confidence in my work that I just need you to read 1 comic, and then you're going to read all of them.
Yeah.
If you like the flavor, you're going to, I got a ton of it. So, you know, go wild.
There's such a weird math on that also, you know, because, I mean, I've been on the biggest podcasts, you know, I mean, Word Balloon has this massive following. I'm like, I can go on Word Balloon and try and promote something, you know, and let's just say it's Kickstarter. I can go on Word Balloon. John and I, you know, we get along great. We have this great conversation. Not one fucking backer, not one person looks at the campaign. I go on a smaller podcast that, let's say, they have 1,000 followers on YouTube. And those people they are so active, and they are so rabid, and they love so much that you came on and spent an hour with them, and they got to know you in a very real way. They're not passively listening. They're actively listening, and they're asking you questions. And some of my biggest, most dedicated fans, some of my biggest cheerleaders, some of the people that promote the hell out of me without me having to do anything. I picked all of those people up on these smaller shows, and I love them, and they listen to this show now. And thank you for listening to this show, for looking at our books. And here's the thing, is like, if we weren't good people, if we didn't have interesting things to say, if we didn't make good books, they wouldn't care. These people are discerning readers. They're discerning human beings in general. But I think that's the thing is like, if you can, you know, we only have great people on. That's, you know, that's why Dave is on. But it's like, you know, if you can find a place to show people that, to show people who you are, to be honest, to give them great information, to give them great entertainment, whatever, they're going to respond to that. And so, it's weird. It's funny. There's a theme to this episode that I'm loving. Because, you know, I didn't know what was going to come, you know, when we brought Dave on, and I didn't even know how deep into this we were going to get. Like, are we going to talk about Dave's history, do the standard origin story thing? But we didn't even introduce him. We just got right into it, which I love, which is, you know, again, I I'm laughing because it is what happens with Dave and I won't see each other for a couple of years. We bump into each other at the bar at Comic-Con, and then suddenly, like 2 minutes in, we're in it so fucking deep. We can't, you know.
You know, I akin it to like, and again, this is probably, I mean, to a much lesser degree, obviously, but we've been through some shit. We've seen shit, right? It's like old war stories. Yeah, yeah. We just like jumped right into it. We're like, yeah, I showed you my coin. You showed me your coin. We're talking war stories.
Man. Let's talk about the shit. But it's funny. So I thought that, okay, well, what are we going to, you know, we're going to be hard on these companies and we're going to say, you know, you can't, you know, you got to be really hard about this. Don't take a shitty contract and demand this and don't go, you know, don't waste your time with this or with that. But really the theme of the show has been, well, sometimes you got to take a shitty contract and you can't always do the math immediately. Sometimes what seems like not the greatest situation turns out to be awesome. Like none of what has come after happens without me signing a shitty contract on Everett. Yep.
I'll say this though, if you're going to be behind the scenes and behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Like for me, I never got paid. And there was a reason for that because I wanted everyone else to get paid first. I've got a good corporate gig. Everyone else needs, this is their gig. Right. Yep. So for me, priorities, I didn't need to get paid. I was in a situation, but obviously, you should get paid for the work, right? There's that. I have no misgivings. That was my choice. There's that. And then if you feel like you're hitting the wall, like I was spending so much time working on other people's books that I was far less productive with my own stuff. And I just literally had heart surgery. Like we did like an NFL book and I worked for like 72 hours straight, just Red Bull and cigarettes. And I checked myself in the hospital right afterwards because the NFL is one of those just giant, it's a colossus that's just trotting across a field and you cannot get their attention until it's too late. And then it's correction, 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 correction. Right. And that was what I was in, just that mode of editing. And I checked myself in, I had heart surgery. It turned out that I had 3 blockages. And right after that, I was like, you know what? I need to be selfish in a certain light here. I don't care if it paints me in a bad way or whatever, but I've got my own stories to tell. And so, you know, when you add like Pepos and Whitley and you, Ryland, and you know, the success, the connections, the forward movement, seeing you guys taking it all so seriously and really achieving, I felt like I'd done enough. Like, you know what I mean? Like, and it's time to do a little bit of like my stuff now, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of where I'm at. But even then, I don't devote as much time. I'm a fucking tourist. I'm barely in it, man. I mean, I tend to do maybe two to three books a year. Just kind of depends. But you know how it is. Your irons are always in that fire. And then all of a sudden, you got fucking 6 books coming out. And you're like, yeah, but that was like seriously 5 years of my life right there. You know what I mean? Yeah. It just sort of bottlenecks in that way. So people think you're super productive, when really you just had all those irons in that fire for so long that, you know, timing is what it is. But yeah, I always just say that like working in comics is like smashing your head up against a wall, and either you're going to break through that wall or that wall will break you. Right. And I've been doing it for 25 years now about, and just a couple years ago, I started feeling like I could see little cracks in the wall. By no means am I through that wall. But success for me isn't necessarily gauged on monetary.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's something you have to enjoy doing. You know, it is a labor of love. And it's like, it almost doesn't matter to me if there is financial success with it and awards and all that stuff is good. You know, you like people to tell you that you did a good job on something because you, and if you legitimately poured your heart and soul and there's a piece of you in the book, you want people to be like, oh, this, I recognize this. This is great. I mean, you know, here's the thing. It's like there have been successes with some of these books that I've done. The greatest thing to me, you know, is, Aberrant is kind of, it is a goofy, you know, it's a Hollywood action movie. You know what I'm saying? That's what it is. But it is more than that. Like I put real heart and soul into it. And sometimes people see it, you know, I mean, it is still, even now, years later, I will be at a con. I will be at San Diego Comic-Con this year. And there will be a military veteran who comes up to me with tears in his or her eyes and says, thank you for this. You know, you got us right. And I was doing this book, you know, it has people with superpowers and it has action-y stuff, but really what it is about that experience. I mean, I grew up in a military household. I wanted to do right by people in the military. It is about PTSD. It is about dealing with loss. It is about all of these things. And I tried very hard to deal with that seriously. And when people see that, when people appreciate that, those are the people that I made the book for. And so for me, the greatest success is, you know, when that veteran comes over and says, thank you for doing this. I see why you did this. This book was important to me. This book moved me. I saw myself in this book. And that's why we do it. You know what I'm saying? And if you're not in it for that, if you're in it to like set up movies and TV shows, if you're in it to, I don't know why else you would be in it, but man, you got to put yourself in it. You know what I'm saying? Like, because the money might not come, the success might not come, the awards might not come. So you got to love doing this. I mean, you're going to spend hundreds of hours. You're going to spend tens of thousands of dollars. You may not get any of it back. You got to love this, right? And stop worrying about what you think people want and what's going to be successful. Put you in a book, put yourself in it, heart, soul, all of that stuff. And if only one person sees that, that's all you need. That's the award.
To your point too, like putting yourself and your heart into it. Like I was in a couple of bands and the worst experience you could ever have is being in a band that's trying to chase the sound that's out right now.
Yeah.
Because you don't know how long ska or swing is going to be big, right? I mean, yeah. Nothing against those two styles of music, but you know, if you're like, fuck it, I'm gonna build a 12-piece band, I need a horn section, and then 5 minutes later, swing is gone. Yeah, like, what did you do with your life? Just be original. Or at least attempt to be original. And I think a lot of that comes from just the idea. Like for me, I'm really good at naming things. I'll come up with a name of something. I'm like, oh fuck, that's awesome, right? And then I'm like, let's develop something around it because it's such a good name. And like the concept is in the name. It says it all right there. But yeah, it's so bare bones and wireframed out that, you know, it, whatever you shit out is probably not going to be as good as the first thought that came into your brain, right? And so. Nowadays, I've got a phone just fucking full of ideas, right? I mean, like anything is in my notes section, but my wife is a really good barometer on what's good and bad. And for books like, you know, The Loose End that's coming out at Titan, I was trapped in a car in Lebanon during a drug deal. And I'm like, if this goes fucking bad, I'm done. And I'm like, right? Just inspiration now, just this looming fear and doom. I'm like, I need to put this on paper, and they pick that up as a crime thing. And it's much more than that, but that's just like the inspiration. And then something like The Automaton, it, you know, yes, it's about a Walt Disney style character that gets murdered in his park, and his imaginary has put his consciousness into a robot body with an experimental battery. Right. So he's only got like 36 extra hours to solve his own murder. Fun. Love Disneyland. It's like one of my favorite places in the world. I wanted that as a backdrop or something like it as a backdrop. So, you know, you start world building and doing that. But then as I started really writing it and developing the characters, the main character isn't necessarily the Walt character. It's the caricature artist that witnessed the murder and gets embroiled in the murder mystery of it all. Yep. So her background is my background, you know, like all I did was I just wanted to be an artist. And my parents would not let me go to art school. And I drew a picture of my dad ripping my heart out, and I just left it on the table. And in the morning, it was fucking awesome. I wish I still had it. I mean, I would put it on the wall, you know, yeah, as inspiration. But, you know, then begrudgingly, I went to art school. And then, you know, 2 years into it, I realized it wasn't for me. And that was like, oh shit, I'm dropping out. I'm done. And then my parents basically disowned me for years. So a lot of that, of her growth as an artist and as a creator, and, you know, her role in the book is her undying love and passion and talent that she's applying to this company. Right.
Yeah.
But then I'm telling another murder mystery, you know, the murder mystery angle of it, where, you know, you get to see that point of view flipped. You know, you didn't do enough for me.
Yeah.
And how that can rot and fester. And so it's a lot of me in this book. And I just made a quiet decision, you know, a year ago, that even if I have a good idea, if there isn't something emotionally that speaks to me in the sure. work, yeah, I'm fucking done. I'm just, it's in the phone and it'll stay in the phone forever. It's fine.
I sometimes simplify that using the terms, not completely accurately, as story versus plot. A plot is, you know, this happened, this guy gets murdered and this guy looks into it and blah, blah, blah. But the story is, why are we telling that story? And I will say, sometimes I say yes to things from Dynamite. I give them a very sketchy pitch for a story and they say yes, God bless them. And then I start writing it. And I haven't really found, why am I telling this story? I can honestly say issue 4, like, I knew there were good things to tell about Elvira meets H.P. Lovecraft, a bigoted man from the early 20th century meeting a modern liberated woman who's not going to take any shit from him and all that. But there's a scene in the 4th issue where she and Lovecraft and the Lovecraftian monster, Nyarlathotep, are pleading for who's going to get the last copy of the Necronomicon because they can use it to destroy the world. And she says, I'm just trying to keep it out of the hands of these two assholes. And the elder god she's pleading her case to says, that sounds like a you problem. That doesn't sound like a me problem. And she says, what's the point of having gods if you won't step in and protect the little guy from maniacs that want to take over the whole universe? And when I wrote that scene, I went, oh, I guess that's what this book was about. What's the goddamn point of having all powerful cosmic entities if they won't do a goddamn thing, if they won't lift a finger to help the little guy? And I'm like, okay, that's a valid, that is certainly a valid story to tell.
Yeah, I mean,
a Cthulhu-like Elvira story, the most topical, like on point story, right?
I mean, I kind of thought so at the time, you know. Yeah, it's, yeah. You know, it seemed to, and it's funny because I have seen some very early reactions to it that were like, you know, he's a bad guy, right? I'm like, yeah, read the book. Like, literally the first thing she says to him is, I'm not hanging out with an old dead racist. Sorry, I'm not interested in doing anything for you or with you. And he claims to have changed. And of course,
right.
I actually considered calling the book, to make it easier on people, I was going to call it Elvira versus H.P. Lovecraft. But I thought that kind of gave away the heel turn in the 3rd issue a little too solidly. Sure. I thought, let's let it be ambiguous. But talking about, you know, people picking shit up, there's a scene in the 1st issue where he meets a bookstore owner and starts to call him boy, the black man. And I, you know, he says, well, listen, sir. And one reviewer went, wow, I can't believe, like, we put in a scene where Lovecraft almost calls an adult man boy. But I'm like, hey, writing this particular guy, I'm like, I'm glad you figured out what the other two missing letters were in that B, because that was the joke. I didn't want to take it all the way to have him. I didn't want to literally put it in print, because that's, you know.
That's like, you know, you can always just, back to what we were saying about research, right? Like, people, it's so crazy to me how people deify fucking terrible people, you know, I mean, and I'm not just talking, you know, I mean, obviously there's one really bright orange example of that. But I mean, it's fucking rampant, you know. It's and that was sort of, you know, like while I love the idea of I love the romanticism of Walt Disney and the whole idea behind it, but you know, you got to fictionalize it, because if you dig too deep, you're going to be like, oh no, I've.
And even when you fictionalize it, look at The Simpsons with. He only briefly courted controversy with his 1938 film Nazi Supermen Are Our Superiors. It's like, you know, the funniest thing to me about Lovecraft and Lovecraft's reputation is, yes, he was a horrible dirtbag racist, and it's in all of his letters to his friends and all that. But he wasn't actually standing on a street corner yelling the N-word at passersby.
Right.
Meanwhile, Edgar Allan Poe married a 12-year-old for money. And I'm like,
as one does,
he doesn't have the reputation as no one. When I wrote Edgar Allan Poe into an Elvira comic, no one said, oh, I can't believe you're writing about this terrible person. And I'm like, he was the worst, actually. And I love the writing in Poe. And, you know, there are plenty of H.P. Lovecraft short stories where the racism is so heavily coded in just fear of the entire universe that it doesn't even strike you as racism. Like someone once said, you know, how can you read Burroughs? There's so much misogyny. I'm like, I don't know. I kind of feel like William Burroughs hates all of mankind, and women are just part of the mankind that he hates. I don't know that you can really boil him down to misogyny when you've got the whole misanthropy thing. So, you know, I'm fine with separating the art for the art from the artist if, and it's a very strong if, it's not in the work.
Right.
You know, someone was talking about Justin Timberlake the other day, for obvious reasons. This is going to ruin the tour, man. And Justin Timberlake starred in a Woody Allen movie less than a decade ago. And the plot of the Woody Allen movie is that Justin Timberlake is having sex with older woman Kate Winslet. And then Kate Winslet's daughter, Juno Temple, comes to town and he starts having sex with the daughter. Woody Allen is making movies about a guy having sex with his girlfriend's daughter. That's a confession. I can't separate the art from the artist when all you do nonstop is make movies about your crimes. In which you are the hero. You know, I always say the interesting counterpoint, Roman Polanski, all of his movies are about rape, but the rapist is actually the bad guy. That's the thing that differentiates him from Woody Allen. The husband that sells his wife out to the devil and lets her get raped is the villain of Rosemary's Baby. If Woody Allen made that movie, it'd be all about how Roman Castevetz is giving his wife an incredible opportunity.
Right. Right.
And how she should be grateful she got raped by Satan, because look, she's just a hysterical woman. But all of that to say, I want to circle back to the, you know, what you were saying about putting yourself in the story. I'm not everything I work on, obviously, is creator owned. I work on a lot of licensed stuff. And my dad worked on a licensed stuff. And one of the main lessons he taught me is it's always about you. You always find yourself in the thing. And sometimes it can be really hard to find yourself in the thing. You know, sometimes you have to go, like when I was offered both Betty Page and Elvira, in each case, I went, what have I got in common with a 27-year-old devoutly Christian beauty queen from Tennessee? Like, I don't know anything about that person, but I watched a documentary where 90% of the audio was Betty talking about her life. And I went, oh, now I have the voice. Now I know what I have in common with Betty Page. What I have in common with Betty Page is no shame. And I mean that in the positive sense of nothing I do is a thing that you can shame me for. Even when she became a devout, she worked for Billy Graham in the middle of her life. And even then, people say, weren't you the fetish model? She's like, God gave me a beautiful body and there's nothing in the Bible that says I shouldn't let people take pictures of it. I got no reason to be ashamed of showing off the beautiful body God gave me. And that is a fascinating and unusual perspective that's worth writing, you know? And I think that's the, you know, in Elvira, the me in Elvira is the 80-year-old Jewish Catskill stand-up comic working a little blue after midnight. Like, that's the persona. Just happens to look like Cassandra Peterson instead of Mel Brooks. And that's the tension of that is the brilliance of the character, and it's the thing I can write.
Mm-hmm.
But it you always have to, when someone comes at you with a thing, I've mentioned this before. I got a gig once writing and directing a low budget karate movie. And the only parameters were the main character had to be a kickboxer and his girlfriend had to be a stripper. And my initial, guy with a, Bachelor of the Arts response to that was, okay. And about a day later, I was like, fuck you, a stripper and a kickboxer are fucking human beings with valid human experiences and hearts and souls. And if you can't find a thing to say about what it is to be a kickboxer or what it is to be a stripper, you have no right being a writer. Find the human being and write about them. And you can tell, not to kick at my favorite hobby horse, but you can tell when someone's experience of strippers and kickboxers is that they have seen movies about strippers and kickboxers.
Yeah, yeah.
You never actually talk to a human being who does that for a living, and then you get a movie about a movie, or you get a comic about a comic. You don't get a thing about actual human beings. And I think the whole job is find the human being in there and write about them and write about what it is to be human. And ironically, the more a thing is a genre trope, the more a thing is a stock character, the more there's a lot of room for you to make them human, because people generally don't bother. They go, no, this is a hitman, like a hitman in a Don Siegel movie, which is like a hitman in a Quentin Tarantino movie, which is like a hitman in a, it's like, no, go back and, how about do a little research on actual what it is to actually kill people for a living, and how rare that movie cliche version is in the real world, if it ever existed.
When I was at Michigan, we had this great screenwriting program at Michigan, and we had this Robert Shea, who was the head of New Line, set up this this visiting artist program where we'd have these great filmmakers, these great screenwriters come in and just teach us for a weekend or whatever. We had Jeb Stuart in, who's one of the two guys who wrote Die Hard and really kind of, I think in the end, made Die Hard what it was. And we spent, I don't know, 3 or 4 days with him, I think. And there were all these classes, we'd have to pitch him, and we're trying to pitch him our stories, right? And we'd be like, oh yeah, so it's like this, it's this kickboxer and the stripper, and there's this guy that they owe money to, and blah, 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 blah. And he'd be like, yeah, but what is it about? Yeah. He'd be like, oh, well, there's this thing where, they owe him money, so they have to go on this. No. What is it about? We're 20-year-old kids or whatever. And I don't think that we understood what he was asking right off the bat. And so he sort of shuts it down. He tells us this story. He's like, let me tell you about how, I cracked Die Hard finally, like really late in the game. Right. And he's writing this thing and Die Hard is the most pitchable. There's this building and there are these terrorists and there's this ex-cop and blah, 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 blah. Oh yeah. And there's this cool sequence where, he's in the vents and all that stuff. I mean, you can really get in the weeds on that stuff. They're late in the game. They're about to shoot this thing. He has no idea what Die Hard is about. He cannot answer his own question. And so he said, he was really in a bad place. Like, I cannot figure this movie out. They're going to make this movie. It's going to be terrible because I have not yet figured what the movie is about. And so he's spending way too much time writing this thing. He had an office that he wrote in. So he would have to leave the family and go into the office. And so he thinks he has an idea about something. He needs to leave again. His wife is annoyed that he is leaving again. And they get into this huge fight. And they, and as happens with people who love each other, they say some shit that you should not say to one another, because only the person that loves you more than anything knows exactly what to say to ruffle your feathers, to hurt you more than anything. And so they say terrible shit to each other, and he storms out and he gets in the car and he zooms off to the office, and he's on the freeway and he's going, 80 miles an hour down a freeway, head full of steam. He's pissed off and he's cursing his wife and blah, 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 blah. And there is a big truck in front of him, like a flatbed truck that is hauling refrigerators. And he's only half paying attention because he's still back fighting with his wife. And he looks up and one of these huge refrigerator boxes falls off the back of the truck and lands in the freeway right in front of him. And he's going 80 miles an hour down the freeway. There's this this refrigerator just fell off the truck in front of him. He has no time to stop, to swerve, to do anything. He is going to hit this refrigerator. And his life flashes before his eyes. And all he can think in this moment where he thinks he's going to have this horrible accident, that he's going to die, is, holy shit, I should not have said that to her. I really wish that I had time to apologize to her. And then he hits the refrigerator box, and by some miracle or whatever, it is an empty box. Well, and, he tears through it, and he's shaken up at the end. He drives to the office. He does not go to write. He gets on the phone with his wife, and he apologizes profusely. And they have this wonderful hour-long conversation that reconciles and gets them all together. And it was weeks and months of terrible things that they wrap up in this hour-long conversation. And he's like, I hang up the phone with her, and then I knew what Die Hard was about. You know, and you have John McClane, and he and his wife are estranged, and he has come to work things out to apologize to her, but then terrorists take control of the building. and he is a hero, and yeah, he needs to save these people's lives, but really he needs to take the building back. He needs to foil the terrorist plot because he needs to apologize to his wife. And that is something that we all understand immediately, you know? And so if you ask him, what is Die Hard about? He's going to tell you that. And when he asks you, hey, what is your kickboxer movie about? He wants something like that. He wants something with that weight, this universal human thing. And that's what you need to do, man. If you're going to spend all this time and all this money on one of these things, it needs to be about something. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't need to be about something earth shattering, but it needs to be about something base and human and important to all of us. We need to see ourselves.
When you're pitching out, both of you guys, are you pitching the heart of the story or the plot of the project? Or, you know, how heavy do you lean, I guess, one way or the other? Or is it a 50-50 split? And maybe it varies from project to project.
Yeah, it depends on the project. It depends on the room, because there are rooms where they just want to hear how many explosions there are.
Yeah.
And they don't care about the heart. I mean, the one thing I want to say before we move on is there's a cautionary appendix to what Ryland said, which is, don't put the wrong metaphor, don't put the wrong heart in your story, though. Someone needed to tell Steven Spielberg that War of the Worlds is not about bad fathers, it's about colonialism. And making it yet another one of his divorced dad redeems himself stories, it's like, no, man, this is about an imperial power feeling the weight of being crushed by another imperial power and how that feels for a citizen of that imperial power. And you've made it yet another one of your absent divorced father movies. And Jesus Christ, don't do that. What an incredible.
I've never said this before, but maybe Spielberg is like a one note dude. I would never say that, by the way, Steven Spielberg.
No, really, there's a shark this time.
Yeah. Well, that, you know, and that's at the beginning when he doesn't have the power to say, can we make this about a divorced dad, though? Yeah. And that, you know, I mean, Minority Report. The one interesting thing, though, and again, I always think about the career of Philip K. Dick, and this is something I sort of noticed independently and then read an essay on it. I said, okay, everybody noticed this. Good. When he started out, he wrote entertaining but not particularly deep pulp adventure novels, you know, sci-fi novels, very tropey, very here's my big idea. And he also wrote social realist novels about living in California that were just terrible. Don't listen. Anybody tells you to go out and read Confessions of a Crap Artist, do not listen to them. All of his pre-science fiction stuff, but he's writing them at the same time. And there's a moment where he goes, no one is buying my shitty social realist books. Maybe if I take my books about robots and aliens and add my heart humanity stories to them, and he does that and becomes a genius and becomes one of the best in the business. But it's only because he fails to be, you know, J.D. Salinger that he goes, oh, I guess I'll just put all of my emotions that I've been pouring into these shitty, overwrought novels into my things with robots and other planets, and then I'll have something that I can feel good about writing that I can also sell because they can throw a robot on the cover. or a spaceship or a planet or whatever. And he sort of, it took him years, but he learned like the most important lesson, and it made him one for the ages.
Yeah.
You know, when previously, if you read his novel, his even his sci-fi novels from before that changeover, they're very like, well, anybody could have written this. Robert Heinlein could have written this, you know, on it with his left hand on a Saturday afternoon. Like, these aren't great. These aren't iconic. These don't have ideas in them. And they went, well, let me put my ideas in novels, you know, like, let me stop. And this is the biggest thing about writing genre. Let me stop condescending to the genre.
Right.
Let me stop saying, well, this has robots in it, so it's dumb, so I'm not going to think real hard about it. The minute he gave up on that science fiction is dumb thing, he started writing great novels, you know.
Well, I mean, and that's one of the gripes I have about the horror genre too, right? It's for the longest time, it was about the gore and the kill, and it was not story or character driven per se, right? I mean, you had the reasoning behind why the things were happening, but you really didn't care about any of the characters at all. There was no real personal touch to it at all. Right. And I think we've massively turned a corner on that. I mean, honestly, it was one of my favorite genres as a kid, just because it was so over the top. And now it's just my favorite because it's a really good avenue to tell human stories, or can be, or should be, right?
Yeah. Metaphor is powerful. And, you know, sometimes the story being told in slasher movies is a terrible one. There's a genre of slashers that I absolutely hate, which is the, well, actually, we're going to paint all of the victims as horrible so that you enjoy when Freddy and Jason kills them. It's like, no, man, I don't. That's in you. That is some Nazi ideology right there. Like, no, the murders are kind of OK.
Yeah.
Natural Born Killers does that. Everyone that they kill is disgusting.
Right.
So that you can sort of be on their side. It's like, no, I'm not on their side, actually, just because everything is. Oh, this person is fat, so let's laugh when they die. It's like, that's right. Fucking gross, man. That's Nazi shit. Don't do that.
Yeah, that's tough.
You know.
Well, you know, there's two worlds of that as well. It's like, you know, you underservice your I won't say, well, I guess main characters, because really the killers are usually just these omnipresent forces of nature or what have you. Right. But, you know, then you deal with certain writers that will try to humanize and then therefore sort of justify the villains. And I'm like, oh, that's just too much, man. I mean, it could make for a really good third act reveal, but I don't want to see it right out of the gate, because it negates all of the fucking horrible things, or tries to negate all the horrible things that person's doing right now. Not really my thing, you know? Yeah. And so I see that a lot with younger writers as well.
There's a thing that I call Warner Brothers morality. Which is, in 1930s gangster movies, your gangster is allowed to have a change of heart, but he's got to die. Like, you can't, like, Darth Vader is allowed to redeem himself, but he can't survive. He's a mass murderer.
Right.
He can't, like, hang around and be Luke's sweet old dad. He deserves, even changing, even killing the Emperor, fucker deserves to die for everything that he's done. And, you know, and even, I would say, in classic terms, the way those movies are set up, Lando should actually die during the assault on the Death Star for betraying Luke, for betraying Leia and Han.
Right.
And it's kind of set up, like, somewhere in there, Lawrence Kasdan, I just have this idea, like, I'm never going to see her again. I remember some review of the movie saying, you can't have, in movies where prophecy and fate are such a big deal, you can't actually have Han Solo say, I just have a feeling like I'm never going to see her again when the Millennium Falcon takes off, without destroying the Millennium Falcon in the last act.
Right.
And Lando deserves it. He stabbed everybody in the back. He got everybody in trouble. Like, you know, in the Warner Brothers morality, in a Warner Brothers gangster movie, Lando absolutely fucking takes some bullets at the end, dies in a hail of bullets, saving Princess Leia. You know what I mean?
But yeah, that's
Billy, the morality of the 30s. You got to die.
But Billy D is so fucking smooth, though. So
yes.
he's LL Cool J 1.0 is what I'm going to say about that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But, yeah, we should probably wrap up. We're getting into the 90-minute zone. But what do you have going on right now, Dave? Where should they go?
Well, go to the Kickstarter for sure. I get out ahead of these things. So like the book is completely done and we're looking to just get it printed. It's a 100-page hardcover called The Automaton, fairly all ages. We wanted to tell a crime story set in a Disneyland-like theme park with a very Pixar aesthetic. So that's just the best way to for me to wrap that in a pretty bow. Gosh, after that, I mean, I've been on two podcasts in 2 days and I've announced the Titan book, which I probably shouldn't have done, but The Loose End will be out from Titan. We're looking at probably February of next year, so solicits this year. And then San Diego, hanging out with these guys. Are you guys going to be doing any panels at San Diego? I need to drop in and hang out.
We have two on Sunday, yeah. Exactly. But we're also, we have not decided on, I mean, I think we kind of loosely know the when, we certainly know the where, but we will have our second annual, writer's block, meetup at the Bayfront Hilton, bar. So yeah.
You guys did that last year too, right?
Yeah.
I heard that was around, like this arousing success.
Not just from you guys.
It's
hard to tell because that's such a focal point of the con anyway. But there was a point at like, I think we started at 8 or 9 o'clock. And I think at 10 p.m., I looked around the room and I was like, 30% of the people in this room have been on my podcast. Like, aside from just the regular people who are going to be in the Bayfront. And, you know, some of them may not have even been in that room because of the invite. They may have just ended up there. But I thought it was a pretty great turnout.
Last time we were hanging out at that Bayfront, you guys know David Schrader, right?
Yeah.
We're hanging
friend
out.
Friend of the pod.
Yeah. And these two like fantastically beautiful ladies walk up and they're like, "Can we sit with you?" And David was off on his own because we only had like a 5 or 6 seater and he was the 7th guy, so he was sitting alone. And I was like, "David Schrader's got it, man. What is up with that guy? He's got so much. He's got a gravitational pull." And he just turns over to me and he's like, "Hey, you know they're hookers, right?"
Love it.
Perfect. I was like, there it is. It's the Bayfront Hotel at San Diego Comic Con.
I will tell an equally ridiculous, beautiful woman at the Bayfront bar thing. I was talking to a woman in Lando Calrissian cosplay, actually. Very attractive young woman. And I got a text from Rich Johnson of Bleeding Cool News saying, "Hey man, how's it going? What's give me the news from the con." And I just took a picture. I said, "Do you mind if I take a picture of you?" She said, "No." And I took the picture and sent it to him. And he was like, "Wow, you got it going on. Amazing, blah, 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 blah." By the way, I'm very happily married. But the funniest thing was the woman I took the picture of was someone who writes articles for Bleeding Cool. And that's why I was sending him the picture. He did not recognize her.
That is great.
I was like, "You realize that's," and I'm spacing on her name right now. I was like, "But you realize that's, you know, Jenny who writes articles for Bleeding Cool." He's like, "Oh my God, I didn't recognize her in the outfit."
That is too funny.
Too damn smooth in that Billy D cosplay.
Staff. And he didn't recognize her.
I think what we need to do is somehow get LL Cool J in a Lando Calrissian outfit. Ooh, I think I'm going to Photoshop that later today and send it to you guys. That's going to be amazing.
Bespin. No, I don't think so.
Mama said knock you out.
What have you got going on?
You can find me on the social medias at Ryland Grants. That is RYLENDGRANT. If you are just listening, most of you are. I always spell it because it's not a real name. My parents drunkenly arranged letters and saddled me with it, and so now I have to spell it for you. But yeah, you know, couple of movies out. Peacekeepers coming to you. New book announcement coming soon. That's about it. Just watch the social media, all the latest and greatest there. Go ahead and bring us on home.
Nice. Well, I have, as I mentioned at the top of the show, I got Drawing Blood 3 coming out today. Go to your comic book shop and get it. And if you don't have 1 and 2, maybe you will luckily find an extra copy. If you're in the Los Angeles area and you go to Golden Apple, Revenge of, House of Secrets, or We Can Be Heroes, you will probably find a copy that I signed earlier this afternoon on my trip around town. And if you are a subscriber to Max or Netflix, here's what I want you to do. I want you to turn on Batwheels, and then you can just leave the room and leave it on. And it'll play all 40 episodes. If you have children, definitely watch it with them. If you don't have children, you might watch it. It's very entertaining. But we want to get those viewership numbers up on Batwheels. I have one episode that's dropped in the second season called Air Show Don't Tell, which I'm proud has a sex joke about Black Canary in it. Shows for preschoolers. And so great enjoy title. That. There will be more episodes coming from me this season and the next. And that's it for this episode of The Writer's Block. Thank you so much, Dave Launch, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
See you all on the next exciting episode.
Thanks for listening, guys.
If you're watching us on YouTube, be sure to smash that like button. If you're listening to us on Apple Podcasts or other fine purveyors of ear crack, please leave us a 5-star review. And wherever you're watching and or listening, subscribe. We'll see you back here next week for more madcap hijinks on The Writer's Block.
For more information, visit pendantaudio.com. Thanks for listening.